Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization, but ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Water Stories, produced with support from USAID, we interview experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water, peace, and conflict challenges. Today, we're speaking to Aaron Wolf, a professor at Oregon State University and an internationally renowned water expert who has studied the history of water and conflict and directs the Transboundary Freshwater Dispute Database. How did you even find yourself in the position you're in today? How did you get to this idea of looking at these issues and sometimes these connections of issues, water conflict, water cooperation? How did you get here?
Sure. So I grew up back and forth between California and the Middle East. And in both places, water underlies a lot of the politics in both places. And so I had a sense that the two were related, but didn't quite know either how specifically or how do you turn that into a career. So the interest was there and the knowledge was there. I started down the technical route. I was trained first as a groundwater hydrologist and worked in science for a little bit and just kept finding myself with scientific answers, but still a room full of angry people for whom the science was useful, but not profoundly useful, did not provide the process, did not provide the understanding, did not provide the buy-in. And so then I went back for training in that kind of the policy analysis, the conflict resolution, and it was putting those two together where suddenly it made sense that you base as much as you can on the science and there's a whole human process and the human dynamics that help people have better conversations.
Did you have a mentor during that time? I mean, was there someone else too that was helping you kind of, maybe not necessarily connecting things, but in some of these sectors that you had your hands in?
There was just in the mid to late 1980s, just as the Cold War was ending, there were a couple of people who started to make the water and security connection. Tom Naff at the University of Pennsylvania, Joyce Starr was here in Washington, D.C. John Kolars was doing some work on the Tigris-Euphrates. So there were a couple of people who kind of got the water and security angle in very specific parts of the world, usually the Middle East. And so there were some people starting to have these conversations and fortunately very accepting folks and helped get me started.
I want to dive in a little bit more specifically around the kind of the work that you and your colleagues have done studying water and conflict. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of describe that work at a 30,000 foot view and some of the conclusions that you guys have come through after years of studying two issues?
So again, in the I want to say early to mid 1990s, there was a lot of talk about environmental security. Water was usually the example that was given, and the catchphrase was the wars of the 21st century would be about water. That was a very common kind of the prevailing wisdom at the time. And again, I was trained as a scientist originally, so I wanted to know what did we actually know. People kept talking about six case studies over and over. It was the Tigris-Euphrates, the Nile, the Jordan, the Indus, the Mekong. And my original work was on the Jordan Basin. And what I found was a long history of negotiations, sometimes secret, sometimes not, intense cooperation, even while they were fighting over other sets of issues. And so in that one case study, there was a whole untold story of cooperation, and it hadn't led to warfare. It really suggested to me, again, as a scientist, to ask more systematically, what do we actually know in the world? So we started to create, this is now 20 years ago, the Transboundary Freshwater Dispute Database, where we started to compile events of both conflict and cooperation over water very systematically over a 60-year time frame, we started to compile a geographic information system of what the parameters were, what the indicators were of either conflict or cooperation. We have the biggest collection of treaties in the world, of water-related treaties in the world. And so doing that much more systematically, it gave us a better overview of what was actually going on. And what was actually going on was, yes, water creates horrible suffering, human destruction, degradation, ecosystem degradation, and very, very little political violence. And that was really interesting. In fact, the opposite. The water stresses would actually bring people, there would be political stresses early on, but those stresses would bring people to the table to actually start to resolve their issues. And that was what the really exciting, I don't want to say discovery, it was known, but the more systematic look gave us a clearer understanding of the kind of timeline from conflict to cooperation.
So that seems to go against some of the prevailing wisdom, like you're kind of hinting at. When that kind of epiphany, given research, given study, when you presented that to people, what was their reaction? Has it been overwhelmingly positive in terms of when people hear that, they say, oh, okay, I can see that, or is it...
I think most water people, water professionals knew it. Water professionals have been working across borders forever. They have a common language, they have a common framework, the watershed that transcends boundaries. And so the water people were almost never the ones saying there were going to be water wars. It was either politicians for political reasons or journalists building up a great story. And then what would happen, I think, some people were heartened, and I don't want to be too optimistic, because of the human suffering and death and ecosystem destruction is still going on. It's just not leading to violence across a border. So then a number of people would point out, well, it's a threat multiplier, and that's true in a lot of cases. You can't really isolate water in a lot of cases, but in a lot of cases you actually can. So the Six-Day War is given often as an example of a war that had water underlying it. And if you look back at who made the strategic decisions when and why, it just isn't there. It is not there even a factor in decision making in the period immediately leading up to the war or afterwards. And then the other thing, and I think it's more accurate, is people like Mark Zaitoun and his colleagues in the United Kingdom have pointed out that relationships are more complicated than either conflict or cooperation, that they're actually a mix of both. And so, and I think that's very true. I really respect him and his team and their work. Now, bear in mind, what I'm looking at is specific events. And an event to me is conflictive or cooperative. So somebody who hits their child's hand, that's an act of violence, even though in their relationship, it's a loving relationship and they hit the hand to stop them from touching electricity. So if you look, we're looking at very different things, but I'm grateful to them for having brought that up. And the other thing that they brought up, which is also important, is that not all cooperation is good and not all conflict is bad. Cooperation can freeze inequitable arrangements. A treaty can lock in power imbalance, and cooperation oftentimes is the powerful getting their way.
If you were to explain some of those differences between conflict, for someone who's going to maybe create one of these projects, mm-hmm. or they're tasked with a water project but they want to make it conflict sensitive, how do you explain that to a development practitioner?
Sure. Well, I think most people in development work understand systems thinking, and that's basically all we're doing. If you're going to build the dam, you think about the impacts of the dam and who's going to be impacted and make sure they're part of the discussion. And that's the beauty of this work. The whole idea of environmental peacemaking, environmental peacebuilding is precisely that. Here's an excuse to have a conversation. Here's a language with which to have a great conversation across borders. And so that's the message in a nutshell, and that's the work that a lot of development people understand instinctively, and hopefully these kinds of the toolkit and the environmental peace building initiatives are going to give people the incentives and language with which to do it.
Going back a little bit to the database that you mentioned, how can a practitioner, how are they going to use that practically?
Oh, sure. Well, anybody involved in any difficult discussions around just about any issue on transboundary waters can find how other people did it in other basins online. The entire database is available online. And so if you're looking for, let's say, in-stream flows, and you want to understand how other countries have kept in-stream flows or dealt with the issue of in-stream flows for ecosystem health across borders, you can just type that in and find the, whatever it is, 18 treaties that have dealt with it and seen how they've done it in other parts of the world. I think that's probably the most useful way, is all of that record of people having these difficult discussions. And interestingly, most people who do feel very isolated. They feel they're the only people who are dealing with them anywhere. And then you find out that there's actually about half the land surface of the Earth is in transboundary waters, and a lot of people have dealt with a lot of these issues.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. That isolation, that it can really help unlock the feeling of being isolated. I like that. Taking a look at some of the research and some of the kind of myth-busting in some ways, does the future moving forward, is it going to look like the past? I mean, taking stock of where we are now, what research you've done and your colleagues have done, what's the outlook?
Yeah. Well, I think there are two. I think, again, the key water message is the immense death and destruction. There's no way around that. Hundreds of millions of people don't have access to sanitation. People are dying because they don't have access to fresh water. That's the key. And I think now there's a kind of a new wave. I think we're in the third wave. There was the environmental security, got the security people interested in the environment. Then the water wars wave got people interested in these issues. And now we're in the climate change and security wave. And people are asking a lot of the same sets of questions. Everything's going to change, climate change. And all of that's true at the margins. The depth of suffering that's going on is not something that's going to be, it'll be made incrementally worse. But what we're looking at still, population growth, development, all these things are just devastating when they're not mitigated. I think in terms of the cross-border relations, I don't think that'll change profoundly, except that we seem to be seeing more of it, more both of cross-border impacts, because a lot of the developing world is now building dams they hadn't for years and years, and most of those dams have cross-border impacts. But also on the other side, more and more agencies, institutions, think tanks are being willing to step into this space. Remember, for the World Bank, for example, they helped on the Indus in 1960, and then they didn't touch anything until the Nile in the mid-1980s. So that was a 25-year gap that there was very little interest or agency to get involved in these issues. And now quite a few people are. The Woodrow Wilson Center, USAID, a lot of the development partners, GIZ, all of them are starting to be aware of the importance of institutional capacity building along with development.
Right. I wanted to pivot a little bit to the basins at risk analysis mm-hmm. you guys did. Can you describe what that is and why you did it?
Well, so the challenge to us, we were asked basically a very simple question. The challenge was, we get that people aren't going to go to war over water, but it does create tension, and it exacerbates political relations, which all of which is true. And the challenge to us was, identify the basins where that stress is going to lead to political tensions in the next 3 to 5 years. And it has to be evidence-based. It has to have measurable indicators. And that was the birth of the Basins at Risk project. We first published in 2002, and it was basically a map. We had looked at, as I said, we have a big database of events, conflictive and cooperative, and then we looked at the indicators. What were the settings in each of these basins when they had an event that was either conflictive or cooperative, and then through statistics and so on, and looking really carefully at the dynamics, came up with some indicators for when we see these kinds of cross-border tensions. And with those verified indicators, we were able to look at basins in the next 3 to 5 years. Fortunately, most of those are no longer at risk, precisely because the global community did what it does best. They help with the institutions. They help build the river basin organizations and the treaties and so on. So we try to do that periodically, just take a look at where we're seeing these indicators and seeing where there ought to be some focus on dialogue and institutional capacity building.
Again, back to the development practitioner, how best could they interface with this study or this kind of study?
Well, we try and generate a map every 6 or so months, and so we have one available now. And I think again, somebody who's in development, the biggest indicator for cross-border tensions is somebody wants to build something in an upstream country, and it's going to impact people in a downstream country, and there's no mechanism for mitigating the impacts. That covers 90% of what people conflict about cross-border over water resources. So it's not the dam itself that causes a problem. It's the dam in the absence of an agreement about how to mitigate the impacts of the dam. So if you're in development, ask yourself, who's going to be impacted by this? And are they involved in this discussion? Is there an institution, a river basin organization, a treaty that's going to help us deal with the impacts of the dam? So in the Basins at Risk project, what we looked at were two sets of relationships. One is the rate of change within a basin. What's happening? People developing or people moving or people getting richer? What are the politics like? Floods, droughts. And then there's the adaptive capacity or institutional capacity. How well do these institutions, the river basin organization, the governments, how good are their relationships? And so the relationship between those two is very predictive into where areas could turn conflictive or not. So it's that rate of change that we're seeing change dramatically with climate change. So most rivers have natural variability. Jordan, for example, goes up or down 40% in any given year. Well, with climate change, now that's varying. And so if you had an agreement on a 40% variability, and now your variability is 50%, now you've got a lot of the time that there's no institutional answer. And so that's happened a couple of times where there were droughts that were so bad that the Israel-Jordan water agreements had nothing in text to deal with them. And so fortunately, the relations were solid enough that they could adapt to it just based on their personal relations. And so that's what I think we're going to see a lot of, is a lot of places where there are treaties or river basin organizations suddenly dealing with the Colorado, the Lake Mead is at its lowest level ever. So these are the kinds of things that are going to challenge our existing institutions. And then in rivers that don't have institutions or groundwater aquifers that don't have institutions in place, they'll be challenged even more because we don't even know what the status quo is.
Where are we with institution building around basins?
I think we're in a very exciting place. I think our U.S. State Department has really stepped up and built up their capacity. Again, the development, the USAIDs, the GIZs, the JICAs, the CETAs, all of these have Australians. I mean, all of the development partners are very aware of the critical need for institutional capacity building within transboundary basins, and most of them have very active programs. And what's really exciting is they're communicating with each other and helping each other. And also in the Global South, that a lot of these, now all of a sudden, this isn't two countries in isolation trying to figure these things out. They know that there's a lot of South-South dialogue. There's a lot of awareness of needs to encourage to incorporate indigenous values and indigenous peoples in dialogue. All of these kinds of things. There's a rich body of existing work and a rich body of research that I think is helping those who are out in the field do their work better.
Right. If you were going to tell an average development practitioner three key points to know about the state of research on water conflict and cooperation as they tackle these issues in the field, what would that be? I mean, you know, three is an easy number.
Yeah. So I think the three things are, the key one I think we touched on a bit, is that whatever you're doing, figure out the impacts and make sure whoever's impacted is included in the dialogue. That's one. Two, water's a wonderful language for dialogue. People in the water community have this language. It induces people into the room across a vast swath of the political spectrum and a vast swath of relations between countries, even countries that don't like each other very much. have and continue to have dialogue over water resources, even when they won't over other issues sometimes. And the third is you have a lot of colleagues and a lot of capacity around the world, that people who have looked at precisely these sets of issues and can be very helpful to you and to tap into that community.
That sort of jumps to the next question too. I think there's another common question we want to ask everyone we interview for this series, and that's, why is collaboration important? Mm-hmm. And what does it look like, especially among different development sectors?
Yeah. You know? Okay. I think our problems are now precisely at the scale where they can't be dealt with in isolation. They can't be dealt in isolation by any single discipline or any single agency or any single country. I think just in the conflict resolution world, for example, a lot of indigenous or small, very local communities, they have very holistic ways of dealing with issues within the village. And these go back 1,000, 2,000 years, rich histories of doing that. And then there's kind of at the national level, there's kind of the Western legal, right or wrong, very disparate from what's happening. And the problems now, whether it's water, or logging, or climate change, whatever it is, those problems are now precisely where those two meet, and you don't know what to do. And so that's the need for collaboration. We can't deal with it within the U.S. We can't deal if it's, we're only doing red or blue. We got to figure out that basically 80% that can figure out what to do in the middle. And it's the same internationally. You can't solve any of these issues, any of these challenges alone within one country anymore.
Yeah, I like the way you framed it. I was also very scared the way you framed it. Yeah, it's like the scale is no longer...
That's right. But it brings us together. I mean, it really does. It reminds us just flat out over and over, we are in this together. And the examples of people, this is what I'm struck by within the U.S., again, that vast spectrum. I mean, ranchers and environmentalists and urban people and tribes and just people in the room over and over solving their critical problems. That's what gives me enthusiasm and optimism.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat. And visit our website, newsecuritybeat.org.